Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. As I ranted a little bit yesterday, just a little bit, I want to be clear, but before I provide you a little clarity, this show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And the listen-in number, so that while you're traveling or if you have to break away from streaming or you want to save yourself your streaming content, 605-562-4209. And our comment line, if you want to make a comment, 425-270-5416. Now, yesterday in my presentation regarding, or my show, regarding my presentation the day before, I don't want to lump because there are independent thinking, and I'm telling you, it's contrary to the model for the John Birch Society. You have to think a certain way, and these are our enemies. You have to attack them. They have this automaton class of what they want people to do, say, and so forth. Do not deviate. And so there are those that frustrate the John Birch Society because they do think differently. They are independent thinkers. That being said, I will let you know that there are those independent thinkers that actually, you know, they're not, they are just like the good people that I told you about in the Convention of States, that they want to help. They want to help solve the problem. And they're beginning to realize that there is no solution within these organizations. When they get a hold of Republic Review, they basically can't refute it. They basically go, you know what? But they, most of these people, especially in the John Birch Society, they cannot be publicly known as supporting something that the John Birch Society has come out and said, you can't do this. I know that they apply pressure. They go after people. They try to get people to not get involved. In other words, they take a lot of effort in trying to suppress, I would say, you know, the open dialogue instead of being a leader. Remember, a leader unites people, organizations, and what have you. Leaders try to unite. I can tell you I've reached out to Mr. Greenlee. I've reached out to Mr. Tu. I've reached out. Let's sit down and let's define your position instead of just attacking and giving me an atrocious book review because you didn't like my use of vernacular and so forth. Again, those were the infant states of this process, and I have actually adopted and placated the John Birch Society and other organizations that really viewed the Convention of States as the biggest threat that they're fighting when when they are failing to acknowledge that we are dealing with such peril with what's going on with the deep state and so forth. I'm going, you've got to be kidding. Now is the time to be uniting. Now is not the time to be divisive. And what they're doing is they're using divisive tactics. And so if the John Birch Society wants to shed their status quo, their automaton type of image, they have to actually stand up. They have to unite on the core principles of the Constitution, individual liberty, individual sovereignty, and say, what do we need to do to work together and to find that common ground to turn this country around? We only have 5 years, folks. The way things are going, it is only getting worse. And Trump is buying us time. Clearly, Trump is buying us time because we don't have the BLM attacking farmers and so forth, but they haven't stopped trying to, you know, pull in private properties and pushing the Agenda 21 and so forth. Trump has not been able to literally get rid of the entire ranks of all of the deep state. He has not been able to fire everybody. He has to literally clear house. Too many people are saying, well, the rank and file, and I'm telling you that there are so many people that are wired ideologically that you actually have to either go through and make sure that you have a balance, or you have to clear a house and start building all over again. But the bottom line is, everything that they've got that the deep state is in possession of, EPA and so forth, it's all unconstitutional anyway. So that's why we have to start working together to get rid of all this unconstitutional government. When we come back, we're going to have Dr. Vile on. And Dr. Vile and I are going to be talking about the militia, civil war stuff, corporations, and that type of thing. You're definitely going to want to hear this conversation. And after that, we'll come back for a couple minutes of final comment, and that'll be it. So I hope you enjoy the interview. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Okay, folks, we have Dr. Vile with us. And Dr. Vile, what I wanted to do, because you're a prolific writer, and as a prolific writer, you write almost everything about the Constitution or U.S. history, especially the framing years or those founding years. And one of the books that came to my attention, I think this is one of your latest books, U.S. Flags.
Yes.
And so
American flag, yeah.
The American, U.S. American flags. And it's not just the state flags. This is the United States flags. And I think we talked a little bit about this, but I don't think we really went into the details of this book. This actually covers the history of how we settled on the red, white, blue, and all of those types of.
Yes.
Okay.
And flag, you know, Flag Day is not just around the corner here.
Absolutely. And so my question is, what was the biggest obstacles for, because, you know, when it comes down to emblems and those types of things, I'm sure that they actually probably set up a committee, just like for the seal. I believe it was Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams who went off to decide the U.S. seal for the first seal. And so what's the history of, and what was their thought process on all of this?
Well, it wasn't dissimilar. I mean, part of what happened, the colors largely were derived from the British flag, of course. Those who saw Trump going over to meet with the Queen, you know, the red, white, and blue was on more than one flag.
Yep.
One of the fascinating things about it, though, was in early American history, you know, we tend to associate the flag particularly with battle. Now, that's changed a little bit because, you know, unlike the Civil War or World War, they rarely go out with a flag flying. They now have flag patches. But that development of taking the American flag into battle dates primarily from the Mexican War, you know, almost in the late 1840s. And probably the general regard that we have for the flag today seems to have developed chiefly in the North during the Civil War, and then was, you know, later reiterated with the Spanish-American War and the two World Wars. The primary symbolism, of course, you know, the stars and stripes. The stars are symbolized a new political constellation. And we may have talked about this last time. In European monarchies, the image was always, you know, the sun king, or, you know, the monarch as sort of the central figure, whereas in the United States, the emphasis was on the states and, you know, basically the equality. When you had the so-called Betsy Ross flag, you have, you know, 13 flags in a circle. They're not, you know, there's not one in the middle. There's not a king or a president in the middle to which all of them are paying obeisance.
Right, right, right. And so the interesting thing, because I do understand the background to the seal, because I think if on Jefferson's submission, he wanted to have, I believe it was Moses leading Israel out of Egypt, parting the Red Seas. And yes. I believe the motto was disobedience to tyrants is obedience to God.
I think it's the opposite, but I mean, same thing, but in reverse order.
Oh, okay. Obedience to God is disobedience to tyrants. Okay.
Yeah, you're pretty close.
Something very similar, but yeah. Is there that kind of, you know, can laugh about it, but is there that kind of passion in the movement and the evolution of the U.S. flag, as there was like with what they were doing with the U.S. seal and so forth at that time?
Again, there was great variety in the early years, you know, from the still popular, you know, don't tread on me, to the pine cone flags that were in the north. You had your, you know, rattlesnakes and palmetto flags that were used more commonly in the south.
Right.
So the passion for the flag really seems to be primarily Civil War, and really probably like the 18th, sort of the nationalist movement connected in part to American expansionism at the end of the 19th century, and then, of course, the two world wars.
Okay, so if I remember correctly, it was the late 1800s. I want to say 1894, 1895, when Bellamy got involved. So Bellamy was a socialist, and he was
a Baptist socialist.
Yes, he was a Christian socialist.
Today.
Right. He was a Christian socialist.
Yes.
And he failed and was ran out. And I think it was up in the New England. So again, they ran him out for blasphemy or whatever. And he ended up going down to Florida. And he was working with a company that was making U.S. flags. And so he created this flag campaign and the Pledge of Allegiance and the Bellamy Salute.
I'm recollecting it a little bit differently, but I've moved on to some other encyclopedias since. But I believe that he was actually working with a magazine.
Yes, yes. It was a periodical, correct. But I thought that they were
directed primarily to boys.
Yes.
And they were on – one of the fundraising things that they had was getting people to order flags. And so this was also the time in American history,
yes,
which is not unlike today, where there was a great concern over immigrants, and particularly, you know, the immigrants from non-English-speaking nations and, you know, maybe Catholic nations that didn't quite fit in with the,
right,
you know, the dominant Protestant sort of zeitgeist.
Right.
And so the idea was that, you know, you would rally around this common symbol.
Right.
And, of course, you know, connected, you know, flag salute and then probably a national – well, you don't have the national anthem yet. They haven't settled on – they don't settle on that for a little bit later, but that later adds to it.
Interesting. I did not know that, but I'll say this. That there were a lot of Mexican Americans that were actually coming to America in the early 1900s, not with Bellamy's salute and all of that, but I do know that there was it was later on. I think it started in the 30s, whether it was with Hoover or FDR. They actually started a roundup of Mexicans, and it was very politically incorrect because I think they called it Operation Wetback, and I think actually went into Eisenhower's era.
It did, and that was actually the next name I was going to throw into the pot there.
Oh, okay.
But again, the flag salute itself was, and the flag ritual was more directed to your Southern, your Irish and your Southern Europeans, you know, that didn't seem to be so, you know, you had Russian immigrants and whatever.
Right.
There was just a great fear that they would not be able to properly assimilate.
You know, that's interesting because you are correct with the concept or the paradigm that the Scots, the Irish, were very because having some blood in that area, we have family colors. We have a family pattern.
Absolutely.
And so that's how we differentiated ourselves from one family to the next. And
right.
Whether
different clans.
Correct. And so I don't want to put my clan out there. But it's interesting because that was a unique paradigm in all of the world at that point in time. Because it wasn't as strong as it was in Russia. And as a matter of fact, in Russia had been for a long time a area of, if you want to call it, serfdom and so forth.
Right.
Because they, you know, had their royalties and everybody else was basically serfs. And they had these I'd almost call it a different modernization or an evolution of the caste system of India almost.
I'm not that familiar with it. I know, you know, there are some countries. Denmark is a good example where there's actually a myth of the flag being handed down from God, sort of a, you know, sacred notion.
Right.
And it, you know, probably goes back to conflicts that they had with, you know, nearby foreign powers.
Right. But it was definitely a European thing. And so I'm going to guess that probably wasn't something that was as strong with the Latin Americans that were coming to America. So they were probably just targeting very specific people to get them to become more patriotic. Interesting. I don't want to take up the whole time on this. And as a matter of fact, next time, because you have so many different books, I want to actually help people understand, you know, the range of topics that you cover with all the insights and the research that you do. But one of the things I wanted to ask you, and I kind of mentioned this, but I didn't tell you directly, but I did mention it. What do you know about the U.S. corporations?
Well, I mean, as you know, the most famous case on corporations actually has to deal with, you know, the U.S. Bank and the constitutionality of that. And that goes back to 1819, you know, McCulloch versus Maryland. And, you know, one of the primary purposes of the corporation, of course, part of it is limited liability, but part of it is that they, at least in paper, give you the ability to perpetuate beyond an individual's lifetime. So they have a kind of secular immortality, I suppose, is a way of phrasing that.
Well, yeah, prior to that, they had charters for banks. In other words, that charter was going to expire. And I believe that actually the charter came up on, and we talked about this with Madison, but no, I'm actually talking about the corporations that were created on the heels of the Civil War, where every government agency was incorporated.
My knowledge on that is actually fairly thin. I mean, maybe that's a topic for the next book.
Good, because what do you know about the sovereign citizen movement? Do you know anything about those guys?
A little bit.
Okay, so there, if you do the research, that'll actually point you in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Just researching what they're talking about, because they're talking about how the federal government, because we were basically bankrupt, the federal government was kind of forced by a foreign entity, Britain, to incorporate so that they would have stock in the United States government. And so, and as a matter of fact, I'm not sure if you knew this, but I was told that the United States Postal Service is owned by the Queen of England.
That sounds like fake news, but I don't know that for a fact. I mean,
okay.
Too much, yeah.
So, okay. But these corporations were formed, and there was also this creation of an annotated constitution. Does that
like
sound
the U.S. code? Is that what you're thinking?
Correct. And so what they started doing was they started basically, you know, creating instead of going to the states to say, can we do this? They just started, you know, saying we can assume anything and everything we want. And it seemed like everybody was kind of on board. The whole point, though, and the fundamental premise in their argument. So this sovereign citizen movement, the fundamental premise is that under the guise of martial law, they used martial law as the justification of not following the Constitution and doing what was necessary to save the Union by creating these corporations. And so my point is, and that's why I shared those with you, because I pointed out, and I'm not sure if you noticed, because James Madison, in arguing with George Mason over martial law, stated that martial law could not be called if the militia had not been called out in service. And only in the states where the militias are called into service by the federal government can they call martial law.
I know during the Civil War, you know, that one of the questions on concerning suspension of habeas corpus was whether that was a power reserved to Congress or whether it was reserved to the president. And of course, the president fairly successfully claimed it, but not to everyone's satisfaction.
Well, so Taney challenged him on it, says, you don't have that authority. And he goes, are you going to force that? I think something to that effect.
Right. And yeah, there was quite a bit of skirmishing between the two of them.
Right. But as I read it out of the ratification debates, in other words, as they sold it to the states in the ratification process, that martial law is only something that the government can use when they use the militia, because the militia was sold as the thing for, you know, squelling rebellion, public uprising, or, you know, any kind of insurgencies or uprisings in the states.
Well, and again, I mean, there was, as we've discussed before, you know, there was great concern over standing armies.
Absolutely.
Interestingly, you know, this ties back to Whig political thought. And one of the reasons that part of it was just strategic, and they were an island nation, so it made sense for them to have a large navy. But part of under small R Republican thought at the time, a navy would be much less likely to be able to turn on its own people in the way that a standing army could.
Right.
But of course, you know, there's been a lot of water under the bridge in terms of, you know, if you wanted to have a country with no standing army today, you know, if you're Switzerland, you might be, you know, if you have a lot of tall mountains and everybody in your country owns a gun and nobody, you know, the cost of invading you is relatively high and you don't have much interest in going elsewhere in the world, probably that works. In practice, militia have not, you know, Washington was a big critic during the Revolutionary War.
Right.
You know, there were some occasions where they performed very well, but, you know, one of the things that as I was working on a book on the national anthem, you know, there's a so-called races of Bladensburg. I may be mispronouncing it, but this famous battle that preceded the burning of Washington, D.C., where the militia actually outnumbered the invading British, but, you know, they had never been under fire before and did not have particularly good leadership. And so everybody raced to the back of the line.
Right. It was... Was that the meaning of Camptown races?
I think that's more a Kentucky phrase.
Okay, there you go.
But it was just before the British marched on and burned down Washington.
So I submit that if in going through those extracts that I gave you,
yes,
it seemed like it was, you know, there was, they sold the militia as almost like the super solution to, you know, both a national defense and so forth. And
they weren't necessarily, I mean, in terms of selling, particularly somebody like Madison, he, you know, arguably one of the defects of the Jefferson and Madison administration was that they were so focused on, you know, keeping governmental expenditures so low. Jefferson had actually vetoed defense appropriations basically in favor of gunboats, which really did not prove terribly effective once Britain took care of Napoleon and started sending right. over massive numbers of troops.
Right. Well, the one thing that I looked at and focused, because George Mason went back and forth and tangoed with Madison regarding the whole point of the states surrendering so much of their militia to this federal control. And right. the thing that it seems like, as soon as everybody went out the gate and they formed this federal government, where were the states in demanding the federal government in giving them the arms and the equipment and training for their militias? It's almost like that, you know, because they weren't being invaded, they just forgot about it. Or it was, and, you know, there's people that like to think, maybe I'm one of them, that like to think that there were some people with machinations that, yeah, you know, we sold this whole concept on the militia to you, but we would actually rather have a standing army.
Well, you know, there's a story, and it's not known whether it's apocryphal or not, but it's frequently repeated, that at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, Elbridge Gerry, who was another one of the, you know, small R sort of anti-federalist Republicans.
Yes.
He apparently proposed at one point, when they were talking about appropriations for an army, that they limit it to 3,000 men. And Washington is supposed to have quipped, why don't we also adopt a resolution that forbids any foreign country from invading us with 3,000 or more people? You know, if we can do that, then we can limit the standing army. In the case, you know, Hamilton probably would have been more than happy to have a fairly large standing army.
Yes,
but somebody like Madison and Jefferson, I don't think they were. I think they were just about as committed to small government as anybody could be.
Oh, absolutely, and that's what I was going down the Hamilton right. big government group that it seemed like the New England states were more going into that bent. And as a matter of fact, there was a point in time where they thought that they would have a civil war with New England.
Well, and again, you know, during the War of 1812, it was almost the opposite. It was your New England states who, some of them, refused to allow their militia to leave the state. And, you know, the Hartford Convention, there was
yes.
actually, you know, a convocation
uh-huh.
which discussed, among other things, the possibility of withdrawing from the Union. So
right.
the regionalism, you know, your Southerners probably initially would have been more opposed to it, but then it sort of switched, at least during there, to the New England and then mm-hmm. back again to the South as the Civil War approaches.
But it seems to me, if you look at how those extracts were and how they, it seems like they failed to do a lot of things. And it seems it goes back to when Hamilton made the comment that if we have to rely on the states to create the barriers. And I believe that they had to rely upon the states to maintain the relevance and significance of their militia and coming to the federal government in getting that equipping, in getting that training that the Constitution guarantees them. And I believe that that probably would have changed, I believe, the direction of how because they quickly abandoned the militia. I think they tried to call the militia up. I think Lincoln tried to call the militia up, and I don't believe he could. I don't believe the Constitution gave him that authority. And so he ended up using a standing army and getting Congress to kind of basically declare war.
Right, and of course, Congress has that power. Basically, the militia, to the extent that it exists today, is primarily subsumed under the, you know, State Guard and your National Guard. And Congress has the power, of course, to federalize the State Guard, as, you know, Eisenhower did at Little Rock, and has been done subsequently.
Right, but the creation of the State Guard instead of the militia, because the State Guard is a completely different role. And the militia actually had, because there was no compensation, it wasn't a, you know, you're hired, you're a reservist, right, or anything like that, or a part of a foreign entity, you are really a part of the states. Now, I believe that there were lots of little problems with the way they designed it, and they ignored it. And what we have today, instead of really fixing the problem appropriately, because you know I'm a huge advocate to say if there's a defect in the Constitution, you have to amend it.
Right.
And so if you want to create a National Guard, then strike that subsection 16 in Article 1, Section 8, and say, okay, we're not going to do that. And strike the section above that, 15 and 16, because I believe both of those regard to the militia. And say, okay, we're not going to have a militia anymore. And see how the states want that. But I don't believe that just going along and saying, well, let's just, you know, we're just going to do this, and if nobody stops us, then we'll just consider it good enough. And so they created these things.
There's a saying that we're all familiar with, and I don't like it particularly with constitutional issues, but necessity is often the mother of invention. And if there's one time, or, you know, if there are a series of times in American history where we're less likely to give regard to constitutional niceties, they tend to be times of armed conflict. You know, if you think the nation is in danger, there's a lot of improvisation that goes on. And I'm not saying that to justify it so much, but I think it is, you know, it would be hard other than, you know, Congress. I mean, even the part of the Constitution that says Congress declares war, yes, they can still do that, but we found a lot of other ways to engage in conflict with short of congressional.
Even Jefferson did that, yes.
Yeah, yeah. No, and again, it, you know, and you'll see this, it's your comments on, you know, constitutional amendments is one of, uh-huh, probably written more on that than anything. And one of the fascinating things is that Madison and Jefferson both tended to advocate more amendments when they were out of office than when they were in office, because, yep, it was like, well, you don't really need to guard against us. You know, we're Republicans. We have the people's interests at heart. But if Hamilton is at the helm, then, you know, by gosh, we better put in some constitutional restraints.
Right. And I think a lot of people forget that when we ended the Revolutionary War, that war was not over. They were constantly dealing with a world-class empire that was not going to follow the treaty, and they wanted to do whatever they felt, because, as a matter of fact, I think Madison kind of either he articulated this or it was come up in some of his biographies that Britain was tantamount to telling the United States that you're a third rate, you know, you're not even, oh, yeah, a country, you're a third rate group of shooters, and that we're going to pull you back in and we're going to finish this once and for all.
No, I think that's true. And in I guess in point of fairness, part of the problem was, especially under the Articles of Confederation, that we did not have enough strength necessarily to be able to enforce the part of the, you know, Treaty of Paris that we ourselves had signed. But, you know, the War of 1812 has often, you know, it's sort of an overlooked war other than writing of the Star-Spangled Banner and the destruction of D.C., but it's often referred to as the Second American Revolution.
Right.
And, you know, I think it wasn't really until after that war, even though in a sense it came to a draw, you know, we had the Battle of New Orleans, which officially took place after the war was over, and it, yep, gave a lot of self-confidence to Americans. But I think it really wasn't to the end of that war that most people were convinced that America was going to be a nation. And even then, you know, you got another 60 years of angst over whether the United States is going to divide into two parts over the issue of slavery.
Right. Correct. And so on top of the harassments of Britain, there is no doubt, because Jefferson talked about it in his farewell address, that almost every country in Europe, especially those who had lust for power, which was Spain, Portugal, France, as well as
all the monarchs.
Yes, as well as England, they were all looking and smacking their lips and saying, "We think we can take a piece of this." And and in some ways, Britain was a huge help to us because they were engaged in war with France. They were constantly engaged with all of these European countries, and so to settle their empire in Europe alone, they had to let us go. And I think the Treaty of Ghent was that, just that. And so it gave us, it was a turning point. As a matter of fact, I read a really interesting biography on Monroe that basically said, because of that, what Madison was able to, if you want to say, accomplish, because he really looked at his whole presidency as possibly a failure. One of the biggest successes, he thought, was his ability to run for president. When was it, 1807 or 1808, when he ran for president?
First time.
Yeah, and he wanted to not spend a penny. I don't know if you knew this, but he
I mean, one of the fascinating things about Mr. Madison was, and this is on the other side, but the first election in which he was ever held, he was opposed by an owner of a tavern who liberally supplied drinks for the voters, and Madison thought himself above that. And that was the only election he ever lost.
Correct.
And presumably, at least at the local level, he learned that sometimes you need to wear the hoi polloi.
Yes, correct. Absolutely. And he did in the following or subsequent elections when he had to. But one of his biggest successes, he thought, in going into office was not having to spend a penny or having to campaign or do anything. And then he had all of these economic problems. He had appointment problems going into his cabinet. I mean, there was all sorts of infighting, and, you know, and I think, you know, it was just like Jefferson and actually Washington. You know, I'm really glad I'm not having to deal with that. I'm fairly out, you're fairly in type of thing.
It's sort of hard to follow Thomas Jefferson. It was sort of the same problem Adams had in trying to follow George Washington.
I get that. But what he did accomplish was he actually took English off, or the English Empire off of America's back. And
the other thing I think that he accomplished, which maybe is just as credit, you know, gives him just as much credit, is he did not go the route of John Adams, which was, you know, when we face a conflict abroad, what we need to do is bear down on civil liberties at home. And there is no equivalent that I know of to the Alien and Sedition Acts during Madison's administration.
No.
And it was, you know, there's a story of his wife when Washington, I believe it was after Washington was burned, you know, she goes into this house and the woman says, you know, she was thinking of cutting off all her hair. And Dolly says, "Why would you do that?" And she says, "To make a noose to hang your husband." So political invective isn't a new phenomenon by any means.
But here's maybe a good topic for a book. I think you hit something there, because whenever America historically has had its hand in strife, conflict, an actual war type of conflict, not just, you know, economics and those types of things, we have, I think, let the bad character out of the closet do bad things. And if you look at World War I, World War II, and the Civil War and so forth, how we have impressed and or incarcerated and, you know, like you said, suspended habeas corpus and done things that Madison didn't do. And, you know, that is an outlier that could be really, I think, highlighted as, you know, as a fellow Virginian.
Absolutely. I used to tell people that, you know, when I grew up, I always wanted to be president, and it wasn't until about 10 years ago that I realized that the president I wanted to be was James Madison. So.
Anyway, getting back to the militia, though, I truly believe that they, when they created the system, they didn't have a really good plan because there was still – George Mason wanted amendment. He wanted to change the Constitution, and that was a part of the Bill of Rights. And he wanted to make sure that there was a releasing of such tight controls that, you know, they wanted to constrain the militia so they couldn't be dragged from one state to the other and so forth, because now it was wide open. He wanted an amendment. It's not that he didn't want the militia, but he wanted some constraints. And because they didn't constrain, and are you familiar with the letter of John G. Jackson asking Madison for his notes on the state? Because he knew, and as a matter of fact, I think John G. Jackson was a brother-in-law on Dolly Madison's side.
Okay.
And so, because I think he was a Quaker, he was in Pennsylvania. And because I know her family was from Pennsylvania, and he sent a response to John G. Jackson that he was not going to give them his notes. And he said that we have to look at the Constitution, not as how we, as the delegates who wrote it during the Constitutional Convention, interpreted it. It is how the states understood it at the time of ratification. So in other words, he understood the simplicity of contract law, that however we sold it to the states, that's how we have to live by.
Yeah, his notions of, you know, and more sophisticated notions, I will say, of original intent rarely are based on, you know, well, somebody privately told his wife this and that's what it must mean. You know, even among them, it's, you know, it's either, is it the original intent of the framers, which is what we tend to do today, and Madison's was more on the original intent of the ratifiers.
Correct.
Now, that being said, you know, that's almost even more elusive than that of the framers, because, you know, it's dispersed over 13 states at the time at different times, and the note taking probably wasn't nearly as good, you know, as it was at the Constitutional Convention. So it presents some problems of its own. But you're absolutely right about Madison's position on it.
Right. And so here's the other thing. As I look at the big picture, because I understand exactly what you said, because Delaware didn't even debate it. They just they wanted to be the first one to ratify it, so that they, because I think they knew.
Well, if they were a smaller state, and that, you know, they had gotten equal representation in the Senate, which is, you know, was sort of a key point for the smaller states.
Right.
So you're right.
They didn't want to, you know, look badly upon this great gift that they received. Absolutely. And there's some irony with Delaware. But anyway, if you start looking at each of the states, there were some states, I think Georgia was pretty quick. They were pretty quick and to the point. Pennsylvania.
And again, probably because of fears of Native Americans. The government under the Articles had been so weak, and to go back to sort of the militia issue, that I'm trying to remember, there was some kind of subterfuge that was used to, when Shays' Rebellion came about, they adopted some resolution basically to deal with, you know, taking care of Indian uprisings in case they needed to use the troops to, you know, do something in Massachusetts. But, you know, Georgia seems to have been very concerned that, you know, other state, you know, when they had been, and they often brought them on themselves, but when they got engaged with Native Americans, you know, somebody from Massachusetts sort of shrugs their shoulders and say, well, you know, we're not near Georgia, why should we care?
Right.
So that seems to be an impetus for their quick ratification.
I would have considered Georgia's biggest strategic concern being Spain, just to the south, because they were
that could be as well.
They were well aware of how England formed them by only giving them 10-acre plots, but creating a more dense population, so that if Spain did try to penetrate into the colonies, they were the buffer, or they were the litmus paper that was going to turn for them. And so I think that they were pretty well aware of the strategic situation, because there was another empire just to the south of them. But as we look at every single one of them, the one thing I can tell you is that there is no disharmony. There's no discord between how they sold the limited and defined and enumerated powers in the Constitution. I love Mr. Iredell's metaphor of looking at the Constitution as a power of attorney, and how he basically says, have you ever heard of a power of attorney that grants you very specific right. powers to sell this property and only this property? Then you can assume that I can sell all your property? No one's ever heard of a power of attorney. And that's the same thing with this Constitution. And anyway, they all sold the Constitution in the same. And I would be okay to say, you know what, there was so much different views and paradigms regarding this power and this power and this power, but that wasn't the case. It seemed like they were just, they harped on the same things, just like, as I mentioned before, and I'll say it again, they only talked, I think out of all of the debates that I have access to, they only mentioned the bank, I think, in one state the most four times, but most other state debates, they didn't even talk about a bank because it wasn't there.
Well, I think there had been some discussion of a bank under the Articles of Confederation, so they were probably aware of, you know, the possibility. But you're right; it wasn't. You know, that was basically Hamilton's baby,
and he kept that really well hid behind his back. But the militia was one of those things they debated, but it seemed like there was always the same accord of how they were applying the militia or how they were doing this, because there was no real variance in what the Federalists were saying in one state to the next. I mean, they may have used different words. They may have been far more successful in articulating it, or it wasn't as heated as a debate, but there was no real, you know, broad, they're on two different camps. They're coming from two different directions.
Yeah, where you see that happening, you see that with slavery, is sometimes – your criticisms and defenses of the Constitution varied from north to south.
Yes.
Depending on what, you know, are you emphasizing that you haven't eliminated it, or are you emphasizing that, well, the slave trade's going to end in 20 years, that sort of thing.
Well,
you know, the same argument comes up during the Lincoln-Douglas debates, is the debates seem to vary a bit depending on the region of the state where each of them were present.
That's correct. And as a matter of fact, it's very interesting how, you know, some of the dialogue that came out, because I know a lot of people that are very unfamiliar with, you know, some of Lincoln's comments during those Douglas debates. But anyway, I digress. I know I'm almost
talking to a professor, so the digression's almost my middle name here.
That's fine. I truly enjoy these times, and as a matter of fact, I'm looking forward to hopefully having you on again about some other type of topic that we can zoom into, because
these all
try to give people a very good historical perspective. But just to close real quick, I just think that they failed to do the due diligence in putting this in good order, or if you want to call it regulate, but because that was what the definition of regulate, if I remember correctly, back in those days, was to put in good order the right. militia, and to have the mechanisms, you know, for calling them up and drilling and so forth. But they didn't necessarily live by due diligence. They lived by necessity, as you point out. I really appreciate your time.
I wish I could remember the Supreme Court decision, but there's one Supreme Court justice, and I believe it was Justice Jackson, who said that there are times when, you know, interpreting the Constitution almost seems like the task that was given to Joseph, which was not only to interpret the dream, but to remind the Pharaoh of what the dream had been in the first place.
There you go. Yeah. I've heard some pretty interesting opinions in the writings of Supreme Courts, and I think the one that really bothers me the most is I know obscenity when I see it.
Yeah, it was Justice White, Byron White, I believe it was.
Yeah. Anyway,
apparently regretted that statement to his dying day.
Yes,
that's
because
the only thing people remembered. I know it when I see it.
That's right. I thank you for your time. I really appreciate these conversations, and I look forward to having you on again. Take care, my friend. Bye now. And folks, we will be right back after a couple of promos. So thank you so much. Bye now.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Well, I hope you enjoyed that dialogue with Dr. Vial. There's no doubt in my mind that as we discuss these types of things, we're going to actually open up and provide you with some insights that you just can't find. I mean, it takes, as one who takes a lot of time in researching and digging through things, and I've said this before, and I've talked to Dr. Vial about this. I really don't get into the journals. I don't get into personal correspondence. And there's a reason for that, because those things are not considered hard documents that are actually legally binding. They're great insights and those types of things, but my study, my focus is on those things that were done as a function of official capacity by Madison and the framers, the ratification debates, official capacity, Madison's vetoes, official capacity, and so forth. And so I don't have a lot of this, you know, this little insights and so forth like the good doctor has. And I hope to get him back on so that we can talk in some details regarding the Convention of States as in regards to the original convention and the history of states trying to pull conventions and looking at the mechanism today and what they're trying to do and so forth, because I think there's some good questions that really need to be answered with regards to what the Convention of States are purporting to do or claiming to do and so forth. So with that, I'm hoping to have the good doctor on within the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow, we're going to get into marketing, and we're going to get into some of the things that kind of have transpired over the week so that I can kind of lay those standing questions out to you. As these things continue to just go on and on and on, what is it going to take to get you involved in becoming a part of the solution? If you don't believe Republic Review is a part of the solution, then by all means, reach out to me, info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. We can talk about it. And I am G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and that's why we need your help. God bless. We'll be back tomorrow. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and Republic Review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.